signal sound.
This is Lisa Calhoun, and welcome to Signal South. I am extremely excited to be speaking with Zane Terrence. From an IBM engineer, to a tech founder, to building one of the country's top founder-focused investment banks in America, he's betting everything on the South, and he is right here in the South. Welcome, Zane.
Lisa, thank you. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. Well, you know, let's kick this off. Tell people all about Founders Investment Bank, the company that you put together and the kind of work that you do. And then I'm going to want to rewind a little bit and help people understand and unpack the DNA that has built this real powerhouse.
Man, well, thank you for asking that. Yes. Well, Lisa, as you know, we're in Birmingham, Alabama, Nashville, Tennessee, and Dallas, Texas. So we are Southerners. We are not running from our background. And 23 years ago, my partner, who was a founder like me, in the name of our firm, Founders, really came to me and said, Zane, I think I want to start a firm. Would you be on my board? And I said, sure. What is it? He said, we're going to start an investment bank in the Southeast for this, you know, underserved market. And basically, our goal was, Lisa, is to help founders because we believe they're at a disadvantage when it comes to the capital markets. And my partner, Dwayne, and I were both founders. And so that's what we set out to do. And I was on his board for 2.5 years and then liked it so much and said, man, this is amazing what we can do. Because both of us had investment bankers when we exited our firms. And we wanted smaller companies to have this capability. So we started this journey, this experiment. And 23 years later, we're 51 bankers, 15 professionals that serve those bankers in different niches around the country. And we are having a fantastic time building a boutique bank that serves founders. And that's what we do. We have about 24 specialty segments. Most of them are high growth segments in the tech, software, tech-enabled services, industrial tech, consumer. And we do some traditional companies as well. But Lisa, you know, my background as a tech person, basically every one of our companies obviously is affected by tech. And I want them to all be at least tech-enabled services, you know, especially with what's going on in the
We
AI
are
going
to get into that. I actually want to pull it back even a little bit further. And for those entrepreneurs who are listening and the people who love them, let's say what an investment bank actually does for founders. I mean, it's such an important role. And you are right. The South may be economically boomtown with 40% of the U.S. population and the fastest population growth rates. But investment banks here are still, if you don't mind me putting it this way, rare as hen's teeth. So if you wouldn't mind just in simple language explaining the exciting work that you and your team do day to day.
Yeah. And Lisa, I never knew I would get to do this work because I didn't go to Harvard. I didn't go to Wharton. I was an operator, a software engineer and an operator that started a business in this space. What we do in simplest terms is help operators, business owners, teams traverse the capital markets as they need to for their growth initiatives. So basically, we underwrite a security in a private operating company, and then we take it to a broader market of investors. And these investors are all over the world, Lisa. There's about 9,000 private equity investors in the US. Overseas, if you took every private equity group and added family offices to it, you probably get to about 18,000 potential investors in these companies. And then you have the VC world that you work in that's very large as well. So we underwrite them, really show their growth potential, their ability to produce risk-adjusted future cash flows, and we're financial storytellers, and we go and make a market so that these owners that I had the experience of doing this twice with my companies can find the ideal partner that brings capital, but also their value-added capital. They bring operating partners, great boards, great relationships, great business development. So that's what we do. So we make marriages with capital and great companies.
And you know, the storytelling, the trust, and the track record are undeniably critical elements to creating that top value. So I want to put a pin in that and help people get to know you a little bit better, Zane. I've been so impressed with your story. Let's go back to the beginning of your professional history. You were working for a little company that almost no one has heard of, IBM. So if you could take us back to your life there, what were you doing for IBM? Where were you working? Why did it matter? Bring us back to younger Zane.
Man, thank you for that. And you know, it's funny, my three daughters, Lisa, 28-year-old twins, and my baby's 24, they don't really remember IBM like you and I do. You know, IBM was a household name.
Big
when
Blue
I was growing
set
up.
The culture of tech.
Big Blue.
I mean, you don't know
That's
that,
right.
You just don't know.
And really, if you trace back, the computing industry, software industry as well, it has a lot of roots in IBM, people that started there and left. So I co-opted with IBM when I was in college at Auburn, loved it, was really working in the marketing side. But I always thought, man, if I get a chance to work for IBM, I want to because I want to learn. Started the day I graduated from college, I started full-time in their marketing organization and then moved throughout my career. I was there 12 years, Lisa, and I still bleed blue, but I was there 12 years. IBM stands for I've been moved. So I had four different careers every 3 years, kind of did something new and was blessed at a really tough time for IBM in the late 80s and early 90s to be a part of our transition when Lou Gerstner came on board from McKinsey and Nabisco to help us turn into a services business where we weren't just hardware and software. That's when I was in the height of my time at IBM when we moved to the services industry. And that's
when
what
you
I
look back, so much has changed, right? What do you feel are the lasting learnings you got as a young leader at IBM coming out of Auburn?
Thank you for saying this. Respect for the individual. IBM had a relentless culture to respect everybody that worked on our team, all our clients and prospects. And then number two, IBM always said, we earn these stripes. Anybody that's seen the IBM logo, it's IBM, but it's stripes. And it means service. So I have learned that serving your end market, your customer, and your team members, internal and external, is the difference in winning and losing. And I think IBM taught me that, and I'll be grateful forever.
That's wonderful as a takeaway and something that you just can't teach in business. You really do have to learn it or choose it as your style. And that style, by the way, I can attest really flows through Founders Investment Bank and the reps that we have had even to date. Your whole team is like that. And it's really different. Investment banking, you know, it's got a culture of its own, but
and you can be honest, sharp
the
elbows.
The performance of your investment banker is what really matters, but I want investment bankers working with our founders that care about the person behind the deal as well. And everyone says that, but it isn't true. And so it really stands out to me, but not to get too far ahead of ourselves. You were 32 years old and you chose not to retire at IBM. Let's learn a little bit more about this inflection point you were sharing a little bit earlier.
Okay, yeah. And Lisa, I love this because I was an intrapreneur. My last 3 years at IBM, they let me run a little project. Small. I mean, you know, I was in the deep south running a small project, but I got a taste of entrepreneurship. And then we were blessed. We did a product for Federal Express. And long story short, my third level manager at IBM that we get to meet with once a year, because you're kind of removed from your, you know, manager right over you that might have a vested interest in you staying on their team. He said, man, this is pretty cool. Have you ever thought about doing something on your own? I said, yeah. He said, well, this is a pretty neat product. It's interesting. He just put that in my ear. A year later, IBM, we transitioned, helped me start this business, become a certified IBM project management partner, where Lisa, I could do all my software business on IBM paper. So if you bought a product from my little software company I started, it was on IBM paper.
You were spun out.
It's unbelievable. So they basically were a co-investor in my business. And I left, I call it an entrepreneurial seizure, entre, enter, pre, before, neural, you think. So I had an entrepreneurial seizure, but one of the best things in my life, because I appreciated the security. Lisa, if I hadn't left IBM at that time, I would have never been able to leave them because it was right. a great opportunity. I was having a great career. I would have retired with them, which would have been fine, but I would have never been an entrepreneur. So I left, took this product that they gave me. They deeded this product to me, okay? Gave it to me. And ultimately that product, I got a patent on it and it was web-based testing. It was the first product that you could go take a survey or a test on the internet, click on a radio button with your mouse, which used to, you had to get a number two pencil, fill out a document, they would scan. That's what it did. We built a company around that.
You patented web-based testing? I just want to double click on that.
It's crazy. And I should have, if I'd been a better operator, I would have monetized it a lot better, but unbelievable trip. 3 years, we took the company. I had 50 developers. We were here in Birmingham, Alabama. I had moved here. I worked out of Atlanta for IBM, but I lived in Alabama. Built this company and sold a good bit of it. Did well. I never got profitable, but I got that patent in February of 2000, a 20-year patent. And that doesn't exist nowadays, Lisa. You can't get a right. process patent on this. We got a patent, and that's when my board came in, had a really sophisticated board, and said, Zane, you're not a very good operator. Meet Chip Porter, who they had invited to our board meeting that was an investment banker.
No, Zane.
And then they said, we need to go to market because you're not going to be able to monetize.
If I really know how honest you were, I wouldn't ask this question, but I am going to ask the hard question. What do you think they meant by you're not a very good operator?
And they were life-giving, but they always told me my board was a serious board that loved me enough to be candid. I was a really good product guy, Lisa.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a pretty good market maker and right, team builder, but I had never grown a business. And that is totally separate than a product person or a business developer, or it is totally a different set of skills.
Well, in B2B software, you've got your channel motion, you have to build from scratch, you have the whole enterprise sales motion you're building from scratch. If you're in the legal and compliance or ed tech versions, you have an entire frame around that that can be a little more complicated.
Oh.
So they didn't love what you were building there is what I'm taking at this moment in time.
No, that is exactly right. And Lisa, I underestimated the complexities of that. Now they had brought me on some
You wouldn't
really
be the
help.
First.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, they gave me the best advice ever because we could not have monetized this. We would have fumbled the ball if we hadn't gotten the correct next partner, which was a public traded company, Houghton Mifflin, that was a publisher, one of the largest publishers in the world of educational materials, was unbelievable. So hard conversation, reality, they were right. And that's one reason I believe for young founders, put yourself together a advisory board at least that you can trust, that will tell you the truth, because the truth matters. And I would have fumbled the ball on this, Lisa. I think we would have not given a great return to our investors if we had held the company much longer. So it hurt my feelings, but looking back, it's one of the best days of my life because it teed me up for the next season of my career.
What can you, so let's break that down a little bit more. So the board says, hey, the go-to-market motion is lacking. Did they outright recommend that you go to sell or at least look at making a market and see what the acquisition market was like? What kind of advice were you given at that time?
Yes. And boy, do I believe I've written papers and even a book on this approach. They felt like, and they're very wise, back then that I had a lead because of the patent, right? It's hard to get a lead. You can't get patents on software like I could. And they just felt like it is time to get, they felt like a strategic buyer was our next step. I already had VC, Lisa, and I had some private equity, okay? And they just believed the timing was right for a strategic sell. And the reason to do that was to further my lead and be able to actually protect the patent. We could have not defended that patent, right? We'd have had to raise $50 more million to defend that patent. So I think they felt like my buyer was a partner, was a strategic partner, and it was. We actually got four offers from publicly traded companies when we did this auction that was new to me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I was going on a road show, telling the story, showing the code, and banking was done a little bit differently back then. I've got four offers from publicly traded companies and two from private equity groups.
It's going to be a lot of fun when you get multiple offers, right? And so, you know, fast forward, I mean, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but I assume this was a life-changing event for you and some of the team.
It was life-changing. Now, I can talk to entrepreneurs about this because my investors were amazing, but I had a lot of investors at different stages. As a founder, I probably didn't take as much money off the table as people thought. But for me, being a little preacher's kid from the South, it handled my reading the menu from the right to the left. Okay. So meaningful for me. But my investors did extremely well, which I was so happy. And they were actually very good to me. They forgave all my convertible notes because as we did more deals, I started running out of money to be able to reinvest. So we did convertible notes for me. Genius. But then when we sold the business, they didn't make me pay those off.
They absorbed it. That's good.
And Lisa, I want to say this to founders, because sometimes founders, we don't mean to, but we do get greedy. You take care of your investors. Can I tell you, these investors have shaped my career the last 25 years because they won with me and they believed in me. I am so glad my investors did well, but I also did well. I was very blessed.
You know, Zane, we have that in common, and I'm not too proud to admit. I mean, Valor's investors are literally the people who have shaped and are shaping Valor's career and the people that work here. People don't realize how important the right people in your court are, and not just to back you, but also sometimes they shine some light on the way. And that's the ideal partnership. But I don't want to get too deep into that because I want to stick with your story because it's unique. So you had this incredible exit. Your investors made a lot of money. You did well. What did you do next? Take us to that moment in your life so people understand.
Well, first of all, and I'm a candid person, my relationships had taken a beating. The 3 years we were in this, I was married for 8 years. My wife was pregnant with my twins when I left IBM. As a founder, you'd relate to this, everybody relates to it. I was working all the time. I was traveling all the time. So once we got that relief, it felt like a burden was off my back. But the new company had basically invested in my team and me as well, right? To keep going. But they worked with me. Houghton Mifflin was awesome. I took a sabbatical after 8 months of helping transition this. I took a sabbatical to really reflect, understand. And that's when I decided to help them a little further until we got a little earn out that we needed for my team. And then I started a venture capital model incubator to help other owners try to serve them along this journey. So worked with Houghton Mifflin about a year, took a sabbatical, then decided I don't need to move to Boston. I've worked on my relationships. I need to be in Birmingham though and not travel so much. And then I started a VC model incubator.
I love the boldness. And you know what? As a post-exit founder, software engineer to boot, still very young family, I can't think of a better operator to get into VC. I mean, that's it's interesting. I was just reading a study that came out from the Kauffman Fellows. I love being a Kauffman Fellow, and I continue to learn and grow in that network, as everyone in it does. But one of the things they showed is, you know, what does it take to go from a VC founder to a VC franchise, something Valor's very interested in doing, obviously. And one of the most indicative marks of success is just that path, a real operator like you getting into the VC business. What did you think of VC? What was unexpected?
Well, first of all, I had no business really managing other people's money, investing it in startups. I was good. I think I could add a lot of value, but the aspect of investing other people's money, Lisa, I probably didn't have the correct team. And we were small. right? We're not $50 or $100 million VC fund. We were an angel group, but had significant dollars. What I learned was I needed more of a team to really provide the value to these early founders. I could be a good board member, but I needed a more operating team of go-to-market specialists, branding specialists, CTOs and product managers that we could apply to these little companies that had great initial technology, but they really didn't have the product management discipline they needed. So what I really learned was I needed a broader team. I needed more than money, more than me. But Lisa, we started that fund April of 2001. And some bad things happened in September 11, 2001. But the crazy thing is we struggled in some of the investments, but we still had some wins, a big win. We were able to get the investors their money back. And I was very glad to get out of that and say, I need to leave the VC business to more established funds like y'all that have a team, that have a community. But it was really special and it ended up working out well. And also, I did experience some big failures there, where we thought, you know, these are amazing opportunities that we funded. And I saw that even great people with great ideas, execution risk is real, but also market dynamics are real. You can get in a situation, at least some of the smartest founders I've ever seen. I mean, the market just did not cooperate. Yeah. And I think Warren Buffett says he's seen more amazing management teams brought to their knees by bad markets. And he's also seen some poor management teams in the right markets do very, very well. So I learned a lot. And I think like most people, Lisa, I've learned more in my failures than I've ever learned in my wins. And so I would say it was fun. I was there from 2001. I cleared out my final fund 2007. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was 40 years old, kind of saying, okay, what am I going to do here? And I'm still an angel investor now. I just didn't want to invest in other people's money.
It's a big difference. I mean, I wake up every day thinking about my investors on so many levels, and it is a big difference. The duty, responsibility, the care you need to have for other people's money is something that definitely sits with our team, and in a good way, but I think you have to feel called to it, really called to that aspect of it. A lot of people get into VC and they think, oh, it's fun investing. A lot of people enjoy spending money. That's not unusual. That's sort of human. But the duty to the investor is a critical, critical aspect that honestly I find joy in. And I know that makes me a little unusual, but it's true. And if you don't find joy in that aspect of it, then it makes a tough business even tougher. Congratulations on the return of capital and your success. I think.
Well, thank you. That's one of the biggest things, to return the capital at that season after planes hit buildings and we had some rough patches. It was awesome. And also the beautiful thing about it, I had one company that covered a multitude of sins. One company that I dropped down, I became the CEO, and we sold it to a publicly traded Indian company, still in ed tech, my background. And I was like, oh, I'm so grateful. So it wasn't like I had balanced performance. We had one company that did well.
Hey, Sequoia's fund that had Google in it had all losses except for Google. It's a power law business. So
I didn't know that, Lisa. I didn't know that fact. I'm going to quote you on that. That's awesome.
There are quite a few funds that would have been complete and enormous losses, especially on the West Coast, except for one. And that's almost at that level, honestly, I start to question, is that a gambling business? So I will say, despite the knowledge of the power law business that venture is, I also believe that if you process today with the thinking that created yesterday, you miss the biggest opportunities of future. And just like you seem to feel deep down that you should perhaps have more winners than one in a fund, I do think that markets are shifting and that the knowledge of how to invest in early stage is shifting, just like coding is shifting with so much AI riding it. And so we're not the same investors we were 30 years ago in venture. And I do think that returns are shifting and there are some bifurcations, maybe even trifurcations in venture around strategy. That's a different podcast.
Very interesting, though. I love it. We need to keep talking about that one day offline. I love it.
We absolutely do. So after you decided that you'd stay with angel investing, enjoy founders, maybe not a VC, your entrepreneurial itch was by no means done. You still had another need to scratch. So is that when you started the investment bank?
Yes, that's when I was on the board and I was 40. I had played out that fund, and my business partner now that actually started the fund, he said, "Man, you understand the tech space and the journey of an entrepreneur. Why don't you come over? You've been around us since we started on our board. Why don't you come over and really start helping founders of tech yeah. companies?" Because that's my background, tech enabled services. And I said, "Man, I didn't, you know, like I said earlier, I didn't go to Harvard or Wharton, and I love my bankers that I've had, but I don't know that I'm that." And to my partner's credit, he said, "I think you will be really good at relating to the journey these founders are on and helping them make sense of the market and what drives true value in a company." A lot of entrepreneurs, I didn't fully know it. You know, I've ended up writing a book, 17 Reasons Your Company's Not Investment Grade and What to Do About It, of lessons I didn't know, right?
Right.
At that time. And so moved over here at 40 and got to be an entrepreneur and have watched this company grow, because we've been blessed with great people and a culture. And so this is so much fun, and we're really hitting our stride now. I'm just so grateful. We've become one of the largest boutique banks in the country that just works with founders, you know. And that it is so entrepreneurial every day, Lisa. Like you, working with entrepreneurs. I get to work with entrepreneurs. I get to go to closing dinners like I had two of that were amazing when you're celebrating. I get to go through the pain of being in due diligence and then having a security breach. I mean, it's awful, where, you know, you're about to cash a check for $80 million. And so I get to live it every day, but I'm not using other people's money. And then, we're having a great time. And I still get amazing looks at companies that might not need a private equity group yet. They're not big enough, might not sell to a strategic, but I like to invest in those companies because I think I can be a value-added investor.
Well, and we like to have investment banks. I'm really excited that this week, literally, a beautiful LOI from a public company crossed our desk at Valor, and these things are not done until they're done. But exactly. I mean,
celebrate every milestone. Yeah.
You're right. We should celebrate that milestone.
But don't put the money in the bank, but celebrate it. Don't mentally put the money in the bank, but celebrate.
It's definitely all the journey. And so one of the things that I think Valor is really finding to be true is that early stage founders building breakout software companies, especially in this region, they don't know what they don't know about investment banks. If they've heard anything about it, it's a lot like what they've heard about VCs. Those are bad people. Don't touch them. And that's, of course, there are a few bad actors in every industry that create that reputation. So I'm not saying there's not something there, but a great investment banker, just like a great investor, is a can alter the trajectory of a lifetime on a financial level, but also on a personal level. So I would like to ask you, because you have so many reps at this, what do you wish great tech founders knew about working with investment banks? And I want you to dial in the people that we know in Auburn, in Birmingham, in Atlanta, in Charleston. What do they not know that you wish they knew?
Lisa, thank you for this, because often, like you said, there are some bad actors in our industry. There's some sharp elbows. There's some greed. I have to say this, Lisa, because it's so appropriate to what you said. My dad's a preacher. And when he heard, you know, I was 40, I said, "Dad, I'm on the board of this investment bank, but I'm going to move my practice over to the investment bank." My sweet dad from the South, I mean, he's a doctor of theology, but he said, "Zane, I'm concerned. There's a lot of bad actors I hear in investment banking and money, investing in companies. And I'm just worried that you're going to be associated with them." I said, "Lisa, Dad, you've got the same problem in your industry. There's a lot of bad preachers and ministers." And he laughed. He said, "I get it." I said, "Dad, I want to be one of those good ones like you are." So it is true. There is a misnomer about VCs, about private equity, about investment banks. Let me tell you, you get the right one, it is unbelievable what it can do for you. I call it like marriage. Hey, I've heard of some really good marriages that are just unbelievable and married 60 years, and I've heard of some horrors, right? So here's what I wish all entrepreneurs knew. Founders know, if you can get a sector specialist investment banker that understands what drives value and what institutional investors want, if they understand that, they can help you as much as anybody architect an unbelievable outcome for you and all your stakeholders. That outcome might be hold a company and take distributions, turn it into an ESOP, give it to your kids one day, but you will have options. But if you don't have somebody with the perspective of the total capital markets by your side, you can really mess up. And the other thing is, remember, these buyers and investors, not all bad, but they're working for their investors. They do this all day, every day. Most founders do it once, maybe twice their entire life. And to think that you're going to go and roll your own in this critical process is really scary. And if you have the right banker, you'll do great. The other thing, Lisa, I tell these to folks, a lot of people think, yeah, it's about structure and valuation as an owner when I get capital or when I finally sell. Those are two things. But there's 38 other big time factors that are related in a sale, your board, the value add, your working capital. And it is very hard. There's no way you can know this if you've never done it. And so please have somebody. And then when I get this, Lisa, my whole career, and I used to do this, Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N, yep, the biggest test prep company, they had an unsolicited offer on my business. I remember when I got that email from the CEO of Kaplan, I was like, this is unbelievable. And I went up to New York. I got to be careful with this. Met with him. This is amazing. They were going to do a deal. This was before I was represented. Okay.
I understand. Oh my
God. I thought I had arrived, but can I tell you this? One buyer is no buyer.
Is no bueno. I mean
it's so no buyer.
Every time I get a call, usually it'll be a text and a call with one of my founders, and they have the excitement of that first appears significant unsolicited offer. They are so excited, and I try not to crush it, but my heart drops to my stomach because it's always going to be the lowest ball they'll ever see. And if they're underrepresented or unrepresented, they're never going to be able to make that market, which creates that competition, which creates a great outcome that they're working for.
Exactly. And Lisa, I tell people, say, hey, you don't have to hire us. You got to go to some people that do deals all the time, attorneys or VCs. Ask them, private equity groups that sell their businesses every 3 to 7 years, if they can. They always hire a banker. Why? They used to be bankers. Now they're investors because they know. And also fiduciary responsibility. They have to prove to their investors that they scanned the market, they tested the market, and the market has spoken to value. And you can't do that without a representative.
And the market is not published. I mean, there's this belief in the transparent world of tech where we're like, hey, there's open source and there's a certain understanding and a lot of things are published and there's a lot of protocol and there's a lot of oversharing. And that's great. And when you work in tech, you sort of assume a certain transparency because information wants to be free and that's what you were raised on. But acquisitions are very, very different. And a lot goes down that is motivated by things that are not transparent to anyone that's not in the quiet room. And that's where investment banks really, I think, earn their stripes, is being on the ball with those conversations day in and day out. So one of the things I think might be instructive, let's just give it a shot. And if it's not, we'll abandon it. But I feel like the operators in the South really understand their customers and a lot of times are some of the best at building a real business, yet they don't understand the private market acquisition markets. And some of the muscle that allows you to be great for your customers is actually counterintuitively going to hurt you when you want to have a great sale. Does that resonate for you? Would you say that there's a couple of things that you would key in on with that?
Yeah, no, that's unbelievable because understanding your end market, your ideal customer profile, and how to serve them, it's a different value proposition. And again, I find that most our wonderful owners, they just don't truly understand how an operating company is valued. So therefore, they don't understand the criticality, Lisa, of growth compared to your cohort, okay? And then risk. These investors love growth, they hate risk, and they love being able to expand your margins, which is our favorite word, scale, right? And it is a different exercise than the conversation you have with a value proposition to a client. And I don't know, I was looking at a deal, literally, this was, what's the day? This was Friday of last week. Our owner, literally, this is a great company in Dallas, $150 million offer that we got cash. Little tech company, they have an unbelievable set of data. And this offer was a while back, okay? Now I'm looking at the deal they actually did. $325 million. This owner would call me, because somebody said, would have been happy with $150 million. It was from a huge publicly traded company in London that most people, you and I would know him for sure, but most household people would know him. The value they created from building a model, building a growth strategy, looking at it, say, if we had this, here's the risk-adjusted future cash flow. It's just apocalypse. I mean, it's crazy. So I don't want people to do this any more than I want people to go try to perform their own knee surgery. Okay. Don't do it. Don't do it. And again, it doesn't have to be my bank. One of the reasons we started this bank is because we want founders to know this. Because listen, most banks, they go upstream. You're too small for them. Most of these founders doing 20, 25, 30 million dollar, $50 million. You're not gonna get a little hand Loki or Harris Williams. You're not gonna get a
win is too small for a software founder. I mean, I know there's a different answer for every business model, but speaking as Valor, we're really very focused on software, and our audience tends to be software adjacent.
And that's me. I'm software to the core.
Right. Yeah. For a software founder, what's too soon to start looking around for who might be a good banking partner when you're ready to sell?
Hey, I want to do these with you more. I had no idea these questions. These are right down the middle. Software owners, you need to start talking to potential strategic buyers early as they will take a call from you. You need to partner with them. 80% of all the deals I've ever sold, including my own, 80% that sold to a strategic buyer, not a private equity, were partners with that buyer before they ever sold, okay?
100%.
So you need to talk to them very early. Now, it's changed, different seasons. Right now, publicly traded companies are buying growth. They're doing acquisition hires. So the good news is they're coming downstream. They will buy some smaller companies if you have the right team and the right barrier to entry and head start.
Zane, I just have to interject that 80% of all software acquisitions were before the Series A this last year, which is unprecedented. And I don't know how long that is going to last, obviously. But it means that we're in a time, and it's because of AI, when corporates are looking at very young software companies.
Lisa, it's never happened this early because used to the corporate development people at publicly traded companies. And again, my bankers are talking to publicly traded, you know, corporate development teams all day, every day, saying, what are you looking for? What are you doing? It hasn't happened because they had to put to work so much money. They couldn't do it in little bitty $50 million, $30 million acquisitions. Okay. They would have gotten fired if they went before their board and said, we had bought two $30 million companies. They'd have been fired. What's happening now? Acquisition hires. R&D budgets are going like this for the big tech buyers. But their acquisition budgets are through the roof. They are buying head starts. So right now, talk to these buyers early. But I would say a bank like us, and we're a little upstream, it doesn't make sense to have somebody like us unless you've got at least a $25 million probably valuation. But you don't have to be profitable. You have to show and defend that you have a moat and that you could give one of these public companies or large strategic buyers a head start. That is it. We have sold, we sold a $3 million ARR company to Caterpillar. We sold a $4 million ARR company to Amazon. I mean, it's like, what? So it does happen. It's hard. You have to have a compelling value proposition. And, you know, we're financial storytellers. You need a storyteller to be able to say, we can back this up, but we know your strategy, Caterpillar. We got you something here. You're never going to be able to do in a Scott Storch project. And we got a major head start. You need to look at this. And we see it happening. Lisa, well, more than, you know, more than ever.
What the story they're telling on the other side is such a big part of it from the exits we've seen at Valor. So, you know, we notice that founders, they get really good at pitching their customer growth plan usually, and they really understand their vision for their market, maybe the market they're building. Maybe they're one of the very first movers, if not the first mover. But that type of story doesn't necessarily resonate with the Amazons of this world who are telling themselves a story. And you have to fit into it and make their story better. I mean, am I wrong?
Lisa, you articulated that better than me. You are a piece that they can put in their distribution system. They already have the customers. If you're selling to private equity or VC, you're talking about your own go-to-market, your ideal, how are you going to, you know, build a go-to-market muscle? But strategics, it is all about reading all the data you can for them. And now with AI, what is their strategy? Where do they feel most threatened? What does their CEO need to tell the board in their next board meeting that they've got this base covered? And yep. Then they're looking, where's somebody can give me a head start because I can't greenfield this.
Guess when what is else their is big happening? Annual conference and come to Jesus meeting where they have to be showing some momentum, and you might be that momentum that they have to show.
Exactly. And believe it or not, still the corporate earnings are so high. If you start as a CEO wanting to distribute, if you're a growth company, a strategic, distribute money, you know, or buy back your stock, your shareholders say, wait a second, you can't even figure out what to buy. And so they're pressured to purchase in areas that they need a head start in, that they feel like they're behind in. And I think it's a unique time in history for entrepreneurs to sell early. And Lisa, again, I don't have to say what people want me to say. I say some stuff that might not be popular. I have seen more early stage entrepreneurs hold on way too long. Way too long. Let me say that again for the slow among us that might listen to this. I have seen in my experience of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of deals, including my own, that I might have sold a little early because they had a patent away, that they held too long. And that beautiful strawberry that was growing outside, that was a little green, they left on the vine too long. It started getting red and a raccoon got it instead of picking it and putting it in the kitchen window. I'm telling you, you need to consider. I told an entrepreneur this morning, and I just said, you can fire me. You can not hire me. It's not a client. I'm just coaching him. I said, I think you're worth more than you're ever going to be right now. He goes, but I hadn't even exercised. I'm just saying, time's not on your side. So anyway, might not be popular. I think I could give you 50 private equity firms that have held on to some of their software holdings that were doing 50, 60, 80 million in ARR that they would tell you they held on too long.
Well, I won't go into the stories. They're not mine to tell, but I definitely agree that I am seeing a lot of that in the South. And I wanted to... And it's partly because they don't know the move. I do think if it were easier to meet great investment banks like Founders Investment Bank, or they knew that it was here, that you don't have to work out of San Francisco, although there are great investment banks. We love to work with people out of San Francisco. It's just that for the local founder who has a real perspective here and wants to sit down regularly with their banker, that's something that they can do. And I don't think everyone knows that that's a move that's totally possible. I mean, we're an emerging ecosystem in that way. So I'd love to focus for a minute. I know we're almost at time, but what you think of the South as a region for entrepreneurship? You know, what are some of the lessons you've learned or are learning? Some of the things you're really excited about people building companies in the South? Anything you see that makes us differentiated in the global acquisition markets? Is there anything in there you could share?
Yes. And thank you for that question. I'm biased. You can tell by the way I talk. I'm from the South. I love the South. We do a ton of business in the top markets. I would say, you know, Boston's still a huge market for us. Chicago, of course, Silicon Valley, we've had some really good clients that are out there that appreciate what we do. We're not for everybody, but what we do, I believe, and I've seen, I'm an old guy, I'm 60 years old. I've seen this since I was 20 years old, kind of working in the technology space. You can build a fantastic company in the Deep South. And here's why. People stay in the Deep South. Talent, having talent that stays, that's loyal instead of jumps around. My friends in Silicon Valley, when it was super hot, the different times when it was really hot, it's getting back hot now, obviously, but it's gone through some tough times. They could not build a company, Lisa, because their top people were getting recruited away.
And California is actually a net exporter of people today. People are leaving.
Some of the people in the Deep South that I've worked with that built multiple tech companies, several of them billionaires, they're staying right here. And guess what? Their team, their kids go to schools they like here. They like their churches. They like the lifestyle. Hey, they like the taxes. Can I be political? They like the ability to buy a really nice house for $1.2 million that you would cost you $15 million that way. So I'm going to tell you, and I got example after example, because of the talent, I believe you can now recruit amazing talent in off, you know, markets, basically. And talent's the key. And I find investors really like this. I've got so many investors call us when we're running processes and say, boy, I hope these people don't hear this, California people. We will not buy a California business because of the taxes and the regulation. We cannot have an employee in California because of ERISA. I can't do it. Now, I'm saying some hard stuff. I'm telling you, that's investors that all about the return on invested capital, the multiple invested capital. They like the South because there's less compliance. There's less friction to growing an actual company with good people. So I'm higher on the South than I've ever been. And I find that companies are able to grow on their own longer without giving away all their cap table in the Deep South.
I love that. And two more things that really speak to me that are just on that same vein. Most acquisitions in the last 5 years were of companies that had raised less than $50 million, which is really interesting. And you never see, in Silicon Valley in California, where the median Series A is, I don't even want to mention it, $50 million is what you have to raise right out the gate. And so that already puts you on a path where strategic has to really be committed to the value that you bring to the table, because they're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars just in your first couple of years.
And what happens to the founding team? I've seen it over and over and over. You know, I had a buddy that started a household name company, and you would think, if you look at all the deals they did, how they sold to a strategic for billions of dollars, you'd say my buddy is just, you know, worth $500 million. Guess what? He's not. He's worth $25 million because it's, and he knocked it out of the park. This company, you would know the name. He started it because it gets so complex. And the cap table gets so confusing, and the story you have to tell of terminal value gets so, I can't make it model out.
Well, you're structured.
Yeah. You're structured. And so guess what? Earlier, simpler cap tables. I will just say, I encourage software owners today to be looking at their value, even when they're really small, because you might make more have more value as your team, founding team, earlier than later.
It's so true. I mean, as a seed investor, it's an entirely different job than it was, say, a decade ago.
It's exciting. It's exciting. Awesome. Lisa, I interrupted you because I know we're out of time. It's exciting. I don't want to put Dallas where it's one of the most exciting times to be a technology entrepreneur. Now, let me tell you, these storms, the waves are high. But wherever there's mystery, there's margin. This time in history, it's brutal. I mean, it is not kind. But there will be more wealth created than ever these next 2 years.
I could not agree more. I know we're at time, so I'm going to ask you one final question. For the founders and the people who love them that have been listening to us, how do people follow up with Founders Investment Bank? How do they get in your radar? How do they start to pick up what you're putting down and potentially build a relationship over time?
Oh, I love it. Thank you for asking that, because we love nurturing, helping. We give content, we give sector reports, we track all these sectors with public companies and how you're affected as a private company based on operational and financial metrics. We'll give that. So basically, foundersib.com. And then, you know, Lisa, because I want you here, Silicon Y'all is how we give back to a lot of entrepreneurs. SiliconY'all.com. It's a conference I started at my farm 12 years ago, and we bring some of the top software investors, Bessemer, Vista Equity. So the largest
thinking in the South, if you're selling your business, Silicon.
Come
Y'all.
On, and you sit around a fire, you drink a little bourbon, have some fun, but you're around right people, because show me your friends and I will show you your future.
Thank you so much for your time, Zane. This has been a blast.
Lisa, thank you.